Welcome to the Saturday night primetime meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. My name is Astrid and I'm an alcoholic. Please join me in the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. The purpose of the primetime Saturday night meeting is to talk about the reason to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, to expose alcoholism not just as a word, but as a living mind-powered disease, how the disease appears in our lives today in order to deepen our awareness of what we are up against. Alcoholism is called ism because it is alive and functioning and it needs to be treated. What we discuss here is strictly the disease as it manifests in each of our own personal lives. The way our behavior is this day, the way we react or look at people, places, and things. We don't talk about drunkologues, yesterday's problems, or blaming other people. We talk only about looking inwardly, describing how self behaves in the day that we are in. Like I said, I'm Astrid and I'm an alcoholic. And my home group is Primetime in Sherman Oaks on Ventura Boulevard and Beverly Glen. And we have a whole host of other meetings in the Los Angeles area. We actually even have a website called primetimeisnow.com where you can get tons of downloads and you can get our meeting schedule. And my home group, Primetime, is an AA meeting with a particular format. And you know, you can go to 4,000 AA meetings a week in Los Angeles and everybody's got a different format. Some people talk about the black print, some people play a tag game, a popsicle game, some people it's a drunkalog, it's a women's meeting, it's a men's meeting, it's a purple hat. And what we do is we talk about alcoholism, ego, and self, and the first three steps, and how the alcoholism manifests in my life, and how the first three steps can create a foundation in my life so that I can grow a new character. The history of this meeting was a guy named Bob Anderson, who had 44 years in Alcoholics Anonymous when he passed away. He and another guy named Frank H. Compiled this format, and for a long time it was just a men's stag in Sherman Oaks, California. And Frank H. is the guy that actually wrote and designed this whole format. And I think one of the reasons why, I don't want to totally speak for Frank because he's not sitting here, but one of the reasons why he talks about alcoholism, ego, and self is because Frank felt, after reading the Harry Thiebaud papers, that the whole ego factor issue, if it was presented in a way to the alcoholic in their early recovery, that the alcoholic would have a much better chance of recovering, because basically it's often that people don't really know what they're up against. And so for me, I'm going to talk about my own self. When I came into AA, I thought that it was the liquor that was killing me. I did not realize that there was this whole vast other area of the disease itself, which is my ego, my self-talking, my pride, my pathology, my past, the resentments of my past, how I was raised, how I got the tools to maneuver through the world, how I respond and react to situations, how I throw people away, my total inability to form a true partnership with other people. And so what we talk about in Primetime is the real purpose for us of coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is to grow a new character with no reference to the old. That I want to be a different person, and that can only happen through deep internal self-reflection and a spiritual experience with a God or a power greater than self. So, you know, I look in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and right here in the doctor's opinion, Silkworth says that we who have suffered an alcoholic torture must believe that the body of the alcoholic is quite as abnormal as his mind. It did not satisfy us to be told that we could not control our drinking just because we were maladjusted to life, that we were full flight from reality, or we were outright mental defects. These things were true in, to some extent, and in fact to a considerable extent. Okay, so the body of the alcoholic is just as sick as the alcoholic's mind. And I used to think that what that meant was that I'm befogged by hangovers, that my body maybe is run down by liquor, and my adrenals are shot, and I'm exhausted all the time, so it makes me anxious and tired and edgy, and my nervous system's fried. I didn't realize the magnitude of what this means, that I am actually maladjusted to life, that I'm full flight from reality, and that I'm a downright mental defect. See, alcoholism in its twofold nature is a mental obsession coupled with a physical allergy, but I need to see what that mental obsession is. And what I came to find out for my own self, really looking at my life today, I see that I am obsessed with a whole lot more than just alcohol, and that alcohol is but a symptom. And if I remove the liquor, all of a sudden the disease plays a trick on me, and I'm obsessed with something else. What they're doing, what they're not doing, how I need to be treated, how much money is in my bank account, the bathroom scale, what my future looks like. I'm so afraid. I have these obsessive, fearful thoughts. I'm never going to make it. What's going to happen to me? I won't find a mate. I won't succeed. How will I ever mend these relationships with these people? Or the resentments of the past. You know, if so-and-so hadn't done this and if this hadn't happened, I wouldn't be in the position that I'm in. And why is that so important? Because I believe that all of these thoughts are what block me from the sunlight of the spirit with years of sobriety. And I often see people with 20, 30, 40 years in Alcoholics Anonymous that are so dry that they could spontaneously combust or start a forest fire. And for myself, I don't want to be that. I don't want to be a dry drunk. And we see even Bill Wilson with 23 years of sobriety, he talks about in the language of the heart, page 236 and 237, Bill Wilson had a horrible depression, 23 years of sobriety, mind you, January 1958. He says, this is years into AA. AA has flourished and blossomed. Last autumn, depression, having no real rational cause, almost took me to the cleaners. I began to be scared that I was in for another long chronic spell. Considering the grief I've had with depression, it wasn't a bright prospect. I kept asking myself, why can't the 12 steps work to release depression? By the hour, I stared at the St. Francis prayer. It's better to comfort than to be comforted. Here was the formula all right, but why didn't it work? Suddenly, I realized what the matter was. My basic flaw had been dependence, almost absolute dependence on people or circumstances to supply me with prestige, security, and the like. Failing to get these things according to my perfectionistic dreams and specifications, I had fought for them. And when defeat came, so did my depression. There wasn't a chance of making the outgoing of love of St. Francis a workable and joyous way of life until these fatal and almost absolute dependencies were cut away. Because I had over the years undergone a little spiritual development, the absolute quality of these frightful dependency had never before been so starkly revealed. Reinforced by what grace I could secure in prayer, I found I had to exert every ounce of my will and action to cut these faulty emotional dependencies upon people, upon AA, and upon any set of circumstances whatsoever. Then only could I be free to love as St. Francis did. Emotional and instinctual satisfactions I saw were really an extra dividend of having love, offering love, and expressing a love appropriate to each relationship. Plainly, I could not avail myself of God's love only until I was able to offer it back to Him by loving others as God would love me. So you can see that time doesn't treat this disease at all. Spiritual principles treat this disease. It's a spiritual plan of action, and the steps can also be a homework assignment and even a spiritual transformation. But in the steps, all 12 of them, there's a plan of action that has to happen throughout the day. And what I've come to find out is it has to be this day. What am I doing right now? What have I been doing with my mind since I woke up at 7 o'clock this morning? How many good thoughts compared to negative ones have I had? Have I loved my life? Am I carrying around the resentments of my past? Is there a burden inside of me? Am I still shame-based? Am I still angry? Am I still living on warped instincts? My instinct for sex, my instinct to be someone in society, and my instinct for security. Are they still wildly, blindly driving me? Is there any internal peace inside of me? So these are a lot of things to be considered, and I believe that what helps with that is really looking at the Thiebaud papers. And Harry Thiebaud was a psychiatrist who worked in the field of alcoholism. He's in the back of the book, the Lasker Award, we can definitely give Harry Thiebaud credit for. He was a psychiatrist that worked with alcoholics and had almost no success at all, until he found Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the original manuscripts was slapped on his desk for him to review as somebody who was credited in the alcoholic field, and he found a whole lot of information and ideas that really revolutionized his private practice, you know. And then he brought Alcoholics Anonymous to the medical board, who then gave him the Lasker Award, and the medical community recognized alcoholism not as a moral issue anymore, but actually as a medical issue, actually as a disease. And Harry Thiebaud says in the back of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, 569, "I now conceive the psychiatrist's job to be the task of breaking down the patient's inner resistance so that which is inside of him will flower as under the activity of the AA program." So we can see that Harry Thiebaud even came to realize that sitting around and talking about what I think bothers me and picking apart things headwise, and even maybe going for a walk or changing my diet, you know, or doing a geographical, isn't going to help us at all without some type of inner surrender. So Harry Thiebaud talked a lot about compliance versus surrender in the Harry Thiebaud papers, and we use this in our home group a lot. There are whole study groups on it. We sell the Thiebaud papers. And like I'm saying, you know, prime time isn't for everybody, and I don't claim to be the be-all, end-all. There are so many wonderful groups out there helping people. I just know that this method and this information has greatly enriched my physical and my emotional and my spiritual sobriety. So Harry Thiebaud goes to talk about on page 34 in the Harry Thiebaud papers. The first of Alcoholics Anonymous 12 steps reads, "We admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable." So that's on page 21 in here. Okay. The second word is admitted, which in many ways is a blood brother of acceptance. Although many in AA meetings have been devoted to quibbling about the difference between admitting and accepting. Very interesting. Harry Thiebaud is stating here in the Thiebaud papers that in the 30s and 40s, when he was so joined in Alcoholics Anonymous, he said that there were many meetings where the topic of admitting and accepting was quibbled about, argued about, and even discussed. I don't hear it very often in Alcoholics Anonymous. What I'm hearing most of the time is what it was like, what it was like, what it was like, and what it was like. I would never come and try to tear down Alcoholics Anonymous or put it down in any way, but I feel very convicted that the message isn't often being presented. Or if the message is there in the room, it's being watered down and it's being diluted, because it appears that, for me anyway, my experience is that there's an incredible amount of time being spent on breaking out in handcuffs, peeing on the Christmas tree, having sex with your neighbor, swinging from the chandeliers, ripping your parents off, stealing your brother's inheritance, all of these stories that really don't have anything to do with treating my disease today. And for me, my own experience is often walking into an AA meeting and hearing those stories, my vibrational frequency can have a tendency to go down instead of up. And I don't always feel better, and I don't often feel better after walking out of a room where there was a tremendous amount of drunk log. I don't feel good inside. I actually would, for me, prefer to hear about spiritual principles or somebody overcoming something in the day that they're in, or forgiving somebody that had a long-standing resentment with. So those are the things that I really admire, and those are the things that I strive for in myself. Because you see, we must be rid of this self or it kills us, and this selfishness and self-centeredness doesn't leave all at once. It's ongoing. And if I look at the disease of untreated alcoholism and I look at the application of applying spiritual principles every single day, I'm going to have a new array of issues and circumstances that I'm going to need to apply spiritual principles to. Just because I know something about AA or I have physical sobriety doesn't mean that there aren't going to be accidents on the freeway. That doesn't mean that there aren't going to be deep arguments, family resentments, disappointments, maybe death, illnesses, cancer, people being robbed, stolen, your best friend stabbing you in the back. So many human conditions, and I need to learn how to meet this calamity with serenity. And that takes a tremendous exertion of my will. But you see, if I don't have the eyes to spot it and to see that I'm attached to something, that somehow, some way, I am manufacturing my own misery, then I'm going to get what I always get, which is I'm going to be the victim and I'm going to blame people and it's all your fault out there, and I'm going to remain sick, drinking my own Kool-Aid over and over and over. You see, the ego is a power, and it's a very, very, very big power. And because I've been so wounded and so hurt for so many years, through my childhood circumstances, through all my disappointments, through all of my dreams and ideas and aspirations being completely shattered by drugs and alcohol, I have so much shame and so much guilt and so much hurt inside, and my ego manifests itself as, "Don't get in my face. I'm alpha and I will show you, I will take you out." And what's really going on in there is I'm crumbling and I'm sad and I'm weak and I don't know how to love and I don't know how to accept any kind of help or kindness. And I think that me lowering myself to allow you in and crying and being open and raw with you and telling you that you hurt my feelings or that I feel really sad, I view that with my ego mind as some type of weakness. But you see, the God and the spiritual principles views that as an acceptance of who I was so that the new character can be built. So this compliance versus surrender and this admitting and accepting is a huge issue that was quibbled over, is what Harry Tebow says in AA in the beginning. And it's something that we talk about all the time in prime time. All the time. Am I under any kind of surrender? Am I still accepting, or am I just admitting things? And you know, the thing about admitting or the thing about compliance is that my conscious mind can say, yeah, I know I'm hateful, I'm going to work on that. Or yeah, I know I'm an alcoholic. Or yeah, I know I'm a liar. Or yeah, I know I'm a thief. But have I really accepted it? Because only when I've accepted it do I have some wholehearted surrender on the inside, where there's a shift in my perception because my subconscious mind has an experience with the truth. And I feel it, not in my intellectual head, but way down in the basement of my soul where the God consciousness is. And all of the steps are there for me to have an experience with God. And an experience on top of an experience on top of an experience on top of an experience. And if I'm not experiencing my recovery today, then for me, I'm just a dry drunk. I'm under protest, I'm in compliance, and I'm probably even rolling back and headed towards the liquor store. And like the big book so eloquently says, it says, what was the thought that preceded the first drink? So what drove me to the liquor store? Well, usually, what was the thought that preceded 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 the day that preceded the week that preceded the month? Because I don't see, in my experience, a sponsee just blowing their life up in one day and headed to the liquor store. And me being a chronic relapser myself, my experience has not been that way. I get the efforts. I don't like it anymore. Two or three things happen. I can't handle them. I don't know how to handle stress. I can't process my frustration. I don't know how to get these things out of my soul. I don't know how to live and let live. I don't know how to just turn it over. I don't know how to become one with my maker and allow God to be the manager for my life. So I go back into compliance and I have no surrender. And I'm not accepting, I'm just admitting, yeah, there's this problem, this problem, this problem, and this problem. And what I've realized through my own experience is that I can have selective surrenders. I have completely surrendered liquor. I'm coming up on 10 years of sobriety. I have not taken liquor once. Not a drop of liquor has passed my lips. I have not drank through this whole time. So I have a perfect physical sobriety. But let's talk about hatred. Let's talk about getting mad. Let's talk about blowing up relationships or doing deeply disturbing and harmful things in my life that now they wind up in another resentment list, and then they wind up in a ninth step, and now I have to make amends again. Oh my God, I have done so many of those throughout my life, and thank God there's progress and not perfection. But the reason why I committed all of those sins and atrocities was because that I wasn't in a surrendered state of consciousness with God, because I hadn't really applied step two and step three, which is that I had come to believe in that moment and made a decision to turn my will and my life over. What takes back my will all the time? The only thing that takes back my will is my ego. And most of the time, it operates at a subconscious level. I can't really see it because I haven't learned to identify it yet. So studying, admitting, and accepting is the first step for me. And like Harry Tebow so eloquently says, you know, and we'll read it here, it's amazing. Bill Wilson says, "Who cares to admit complete defeat? Practically no one. Every natural instinct cries out against the idea of personal powerlessness. It's truly awful to admit that glass in hand, or pick your poison, whatever in hand, pipe, you know, porn, chocolate cake, scratch cards, I don't even know, whatever in hand, I warp my mind into such an obsession for destructive drinking and thinking that only an act of God or an act of providence could remove it." And then down in the fourth paragraph on the same page, 21, Bill Wilson says, "We know that little good can come to any alcoholic who joins AA unless he's first accepted his devastating weakness and all of its consequences." So here, what Tebow talks about in the Harry Tebow papers, admitting and accepting, is right here in the 12 and 12 on the very first page, page 21, in step one. You know, and I know sometimes people want to argue and they're like, "Oh God, Harry Tebow, you know, he was a psychiatrist, he doesn't really belong." Harry Tebow is just as AA as apple pie is to America. Harry Tebow and Bill Wilson were friends to the end. Harry Tebow was on the board at Alcoholics Anonymous. They were yoked. I mean, they were such good friends, and Harry Tebow did so much work for AA, and Bill Wilson did so much work for Harry Tebow. As a matter of fact, Marty Mann, who they call the first lady of Alcoholics Anonymous, she was a very hopeless drunk at the hospital that Harry Tebow had worked at for years, and the original manuscript, that big fat one before it was published, landed on Harry Tebow's desk, and he gave it to this hopeless drunk woman and said, "Please read this." And she read it and didn't like it, and she resisted it, and part of what she resisted was the surrender. And then she kept drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking and drinking and coming back and drinking again, and then finally she went to some AA meetings, she picked up the book again, and she fell in love with it. And, you know, one of the things that I really love is that there's a couple of things she said, because she had a surrender. As Marty Mann read on in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, she was thrilled to learn that she truly wasn't crazy, but instead that she had an illness called alcoholism. You see, that was such a relief to her. She had tried to kill herself. She would get fat, she would get skinny, she would go in hospital, she would go out of hospital. She was really alpha. She would get into people's faces. Can you all relate? You know, most alcoholics are. And Harry Tebow was a huge part of her recovery. So they joined hand in hand together. And, you know, she, like Bill Wilson, had a huge white light experience. The room was alive and she was a different person. The walls crumbled and the light streamed in. I wasn't trapped anymore. I wasn't helpless. I was free, totally and completely free. This wasn't religion. This was freedom. Freedom from anger, freedom from fear, freedom to know happiness and love. And it happened to her just like that, because the ego accepted the truth instead of admitting, instead of the compliance. And when this God consciousness mind comes in, it comes in through the heart, it comes in through the subconscious mind, and we have this unbelievable experience where, listen to what she says, "Marty lifted her head to a new world. She looked through her little window under the eaves." Mind you, she's in a hospital with a freaking gown open in the back, you know? "And everything was completely different. The sky was blue and the grass was greener." And you know, anyone that's had a true surrender knows that that's possible, and it happens in the wink of an eye. It's not through the homework of the steps or setting up chairs or cleaning ashtrays or making coffee. Service work is amazing. Trust me. I really believe in it. I am so wholeheartedly invested in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll clean up, I'll set up, I'll wash out a coffee pot, I'll bring literature past the basket. Doesn't matter what it is. I love AA. But that's not what keeps me sober. What keeps me sober is the surrender on the inside that I have so much peace with God in the day that I'm in that why would I ever want to throw my life away and drink again? And that's the place where we have to stay. You know, and people talk about a pink cloud or a surrendered experience, and then sometimes an old timer will come and squash it, or my mind will tell me that the pink cloud is only in the first 30, 60, or 90 days. I beg to differ because my own personal experience is that I've lived in a pink cloud for almost 10 years, but I work very hard at it. It does not come easy. God doesn't just sprinkle pixie dust on me and poof, I get a surrender every day. There are things that deeply, deeply disturb me. And there is so much hurt and so much harm inside of me. And I can tell you, I have inventoried and inventoried my resentments. And every time I've inventoried, there are some resentments that were on the first resentment list. They were on the second resentment list. They were on the third resentment list. They were on the fourth resentment list. And they might even wind up on the next resentment list because they don't go all at once. Bill Wilson talks about the subconscious mind. He says, step 8, very deep, sometimes quite forgotten, damaging emotional conflicts persist below the level of consciousness. At the time of these occurrences, they may have actually given our emotions violent twists, which have since discolored our personalities and altered our lives for the worse. This isn't to make my parents wrong or to put blame on anyone. I was yelled at a lot. I was spanked and I wasn't nurtured. My household environment was full of a lot of chaos. It wasn't the type of environment where I was able to process my feelings. I wasn't able to go to a mom or a dad and lay on their lap and say, somebody bullied me or somebody hurt me. Or even, God forbid, to go to a parent and to say, I'm not feeling heard. I'm feeling really, really misunderstood. That's not how it went down at all, you know? And so for me, it was like, children should be seen and not heard. Shut up. You don't have any right to say anything here. And what that did was that created a situation where I pushed and I pushed and I pushed and I pushed and I pushed everything that ever happened to me all the way down into the basement. And I shoved it inside. And what do you think that did to my character? Made me very frustrated, very sick, very angry at a really early age. I had a very difficult time trusting people. My picker was broken at such an early age. Good people, kind people, loving people, don't get them too close to me. You know, you've got to be a little bit crazy, a little bit edgy, and a little bit violent, and then that feels good for me. Scream at me, yell at me, call me names, and now I'm okay. And I have to look back at that, and I have to see that. See, that's the character that I bring into Alcoholics Anonymous, whether I'm 20, 30, 40, or 50 years old. So this is not to blame my parents, because everybody does the best they can when they raise their children. But my environment created the internal structure of my ego and my warped instincts and my ability to maneuver and survive in my society with my warped tools, and that doesn't go away. With liquor getting a plug in the jug, it's not going to go away. I'm still going to lie. I'm still going to cheat. I'm still going to steal. I'm still going to cower away from you. I'm afraid of intimacy. Don't get too close. It feels a little bit creepy. I don't know how to hug. Not too very long. Don't pull me so close. You know, all of these things. I don't know how to say I'm sorry. That's for weaklings. I know I did something wrong. You know, you don't say hi to me. I think you hate me and I never talk to you again. And all of these things aren't going to go away because I put the plug in the jug. So I have to get down to causes and conditions. So when I really take a look at step 1 in Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, I'm powerless over liquor, dash, that my life is unmanageable. Well, you probably wouldn't even be looking at this right now or listening to it if you weren't powerless over alcohol or whatever substance you want to pick. You know, this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, but we have a lot of information these days. Neuroscientists have figured out that not only the addiction for alcohol, but the compulsion for porn and sex and crack and meth and gambling and eating all run across the exact same neural pathway, which is the reward system. I do the deed, I drink the thing, I do the thing, I get a reward. What is the reward? I feel better. Those things that were bothering me a minute ago aren't bothering me anymore. What a nice reward. Tomorrow I get up again, I'm gonna do it again. I did it, got a reward. I feel so much better. But at one point or another, I cross over an invisible line. They call it an invisible line because it's invisible. I don't know when I crossed over, and now I've lost the freedom of choice. I can't stop. I don't wake up with a choice of, should I try to get rid of my resentments today to feel better? I wake up with, I'm so irritated, and if I don't have liquor, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I stunt myself from growing. When I started drinking, I really, really, really stunted my emotional sobriety, my emotional state, my emotional maturity. And I already didn't know how to problem solve or get along with people or back down or even not interrupt or interject my opinion or get into people's faces. And now I have years of drinking, which have made me even sicker and kept me sick. So I arrive at 30 or 40 or 50 years old in AA and I have no tools. I don't know how to live. I don't know how to maneuver through this world, and my ego will go to its grave telling me that that's a lie, because the only reliance I've ever had is on my ego to help me maneuver, and the idea of surrendering and backing down seems absolutely terrifying to me, because I've never even considered turning my will and my thought life over to a power. So I look at this step, second half of step one, and I see that my life has become unmanageable. Well, it's not just my outside life, it's my internal life. My thought life is so unmanageable. I cannot even get in my car without looking at the freeway, without looking at people, without looking at the downside. I can't even walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous if I'm not connected to God and already start seeing, oh my God, I don't like that person, I do like that person, that share was a little bit weird. I have an opinion for everything, whether it's my paycheck, Whole Foods, what's in the refrigerator, the bathroom scale. It doesn't matter what it is, what you're saying, how you're saying it, why don't you use the English language properly, what's up with those teeth, why didn't you ever get braces, what's up with the hair, what's up with the color, what's up with the shoes. And you see, I need to look for my own life at where those opinions are coming from and what purpose are they serving today, because I can tell you this, that I'm the only one that's completely uncomfortable when I'm manufacturing those thoughts. When those thoughts are coming from the subconscious mind up to a conscious mind, I'm not connected to everybody. I'm not having a good life. I'm in opinion, I'm in disturbance, I'm in a warped instinct for security, things need to go my way, people need to treat me a certain way, and I'm gonna remain sick forever and ever and ever and ever. And so often, including myself, I've gone through the steps mechanically. I think I got the best sponsor. I think I'm going to the right meeting. You know, I think I got a leather-bound big book with my name on it now. And oh, that's going to do it for me. Let me tell you, there's only one thing that's going to do it for me. And that's continuously turning my will and my thought life over to the care of a power. A power that's understood for my life. That it is the power for my life. I will never understand God because the concept of God is so infinite that there's no understanding. The ego cannot wrap itself around the idea and digest the idea of God. God can only be experienced, and it can only be experienced in the moment. So if God can only be experienced in the moment, then I have to look at every single moment of my life. What exactly is my mind doing right here, right now? How many negative thoughts compared to how many positive thoughts? Maybe you're looking at me and you're thinking, what's wrong with this lady? Does she think she knows everything? How come she talks so much? What is she, some old hippie freak? What does she think, she's the boss of AA? Who knows what your mind is saying? I know what my mind does when I look at other people. So I start to see that, and I start to hear this information that the only time I can have a real true relationship with God is in the present moment. I have to look at what my mind's doing. And I come to this realization that I'm either talking to the disease or I'm talking to a power. And I look at step two and I have to come to believe that there is a power that can restore me to sanity. In the big book, sanity is defined as soundness of mind. And what I just explained to you does not sound like a very sound mind at all. And those disturbing thoughts will lead me back to the liquor store eventually, or will diminish the quality of my life. And there's no way for me to really, really enjoy my life and enjoy relationships and continue to grow and flourish and get more out of the subconscious mind so I can be filled with the sunlight of the spirit. So I look at this step two concept, and unfortunately, religion's gotten such a bad name out there that sometimes people look at AA and they think it's some type of religion or it's a cult. I mean, these are all, once again, just egoic words to block ourselves from having an experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. My belief, and I'm entitled to my belief is that God channeled Alcoholics Anonymous through Bill Wilson and Dr. Bob because we needed to get help out here. And the whole world of addiction and alcoholism has been transformed because of Alcoholics Anonymous. And who could Bill and Bob have ever known how sick the population of the world was going to get? You know, the statistic is that 6% of the population are alcoholics. I believe that probably if we add addicts in there, way more than 6%. I think most people use a crutch for something because they can't process their pain, because they can't process their frustration, because they can't express themselves, because they don't know how to back down, because they've never learned what forgiveness is. They've never learned how to live in a place where you live and let live. So going back to step two, when I come to believe that there's a power that's greater than myself that can restore me, that doesn't mean that I just like make a decision to believe. What that means is that I have to have an experience with God. So how do I have an experience with God? Well, Emmett Fox, Sermon on the Mount, was the first book that Bill and Bob used, and they used to go see Emmett Fox speak at Carnegie Hall. And this was a book that was on Bill Wilson's desk all the way to his death. And so Emmett Fox was what I would call a Christian mystic, and he broke apart some things, aspects in the Bible, and he took the Beatitudes and he broke them down metaphysically. So Emmett Fox, one of the Beatitudes, the first one is, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." And here's what Emmett says. "To be poor in spirit does not in the least mean the thing we call poor-spirited. To be poor in spirit means to have emptied myself out of all desire to exercise my personal self-will. And what is just as important is to have renounced all preconceived opinions in the wholehearted search for God." So if I'm looking down on religion and I'm thinking I've tried that before or I've been to that AA thing, I have a preconceived idea of what AA is. I have a preconceived idea of what God is. I have a preconceived idea of religion, what religion is. And one more time, it's the ego. And he's in compliance. And he's in admitting. But he's not in acceptance. And the ego says, well, yeah, there's probably a God. But I'm talking about a God for my life. For my life. I'm talking about my recovery. I'm talking about my experiential relationship with God. Have I had an experience with God? Do I continue to have experiences with God? And this is something you're going to have to ask your own self. Because it's only a program where you can diagnose yourself and you're the only one that can really get self-honest enough. Sponsorship is great. Fellowship is great. But I'm telling you, the self-honesty and the self-awareness, that's the key. So, it means to be willing to set aside my present habits of thought, my present views and prejudice, my present way of life if necessary. In fact, anything and everything that can stand in the way of me finding God. So, what I hear Emmett saying is that I need to find God. I need to find God in order to even grow, in order to have an experience, and God isn't on the outside. I don't go to a church. I don't go somewhere to find a God. I look inwardly. And like it says on page 55 in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says that it says, actually, we were fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. It may be obscured by calamity, by pomp, by worship, or other things, but in some form or another, it is there. For faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives are facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of a power was a part of our makeup. Oh my God. Dun, 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 dun. So, but Bill Wilson's saying faith in God is part of our makeup. I'm wired for God. I am wired to have a faithful relationship with God. This is part of my makeup. This is a good thing. Part of my makeup is drinking water, eating healthy food, loving, procreating, building a home, feeling creative. Part of my makeup is also wanting a relationship with God. God was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, that is where God may be found, and so it is with us. So Bill Wilson says that I have to find God deep down inside of me. It's not out there. It's not in a star. It's not in a book. It's not in a pipe. It's not in a bottle. It's not in a hymn. It's not in a her. It's in a spiritual experience. Here's where the ego, one more time, gets a little bit tricky, because the ego still has an agenda, and the ego says, when I get the job, when I get the tits, when I get skinny, when I get the guy, when I get the house, when I get the whatever it is, I'm going to be okay. But I have news for you. Through my own experience, I chased all of those third dimensional things and nothing treated my disease. I'd run like crazy on a scavenger hunt, trying to get the thing. Sometimes some things would take me like a year or two to achieve a certain thing. And I'd get there and I'd get it in my clutches. Didn't treat my disease. 72 hours later, that's not the right thing. And then my ego would say, it's over there. And I'd go after that thing. So what I say to people is, if you still believe that there's something out there that can treat your disease, my suggestion is go run that thing till the wheels fall off, because we all need to have a surrender. And until we have a surrender, we're probably not going to really go for this literature. So often people think AA is hokey. They don't want to do it as a way of life. They think it's for idiots. It's not for them. Their mind just shuts on it. And so for me, I had to have an enormous surrender that there was nothing left but God. There was no other choice. There was nothing left on the menu that was going to restore me except a life of prayer and service and devotion to God and to AA. So I look at step two of coming to believe that there's a power. And you look in step 11 and it says that I seek through prayer and meditation to improve my conscious contact with God. Well, my conscious contact, wouldn't that be now? Or would it be then? Would it be next week, or would it be only in the morning? Would it be when I get on the freeway, or would it be only when I get mad? And so I have to come to the realization for my own self, through my own experience, that a conscious contact with God would mean now, right now. Now is the only time I can really have a conscious contact with God. And I'm always working to improve my conscious contact with God. There's one that has all power. That one is this God. May we find him now. What does now mean? To me, now means right now, means right now, means right now, means right now. So every day is the day I must carry the vision of God's will for me into all of my activities. My activities start with my thought life and then channel down into my physical life, into my behavioral life. So I need to look at this belief system and where I'm falling short. Do I believe? Is there a God out there or isn't there? And so for me, I believe that God's experiential. So what I was asked to do was start asking God to protect me from my mind and my thought life, because the main part of the disease centers in my mind, and I'm either talking to myself or I'm talking to a power. And my mind runs in untreated alcoholism all day long. If I don't bring this power with me everywhere I go, I will get hijacked to Cuba in 2 seconds flat. And I don't know how everyone else's alcoholism manifests. I can tell you for mine, I get deeply disturbed and I get frustrated and I get angry really quickly. Some people push it the other way. They suppress it and they just get depressed and they roll around and marinate in it and they look at the downside. I'm just ready to take somebody out. I'm ready for Freddy. I'm going to get in a fight. I'm going to get in an argument. You can see I'm on my muscle. You can see my whole body language change. Oh, yeah. And it does not feel good. So I look at this step two and I start playing with these ideas and I start doing this as an application for my life. And I start asking God to be with me. And I pray, like Emmett Fox says, he says, pray with intention. So he says in the Golden Key, he says, pray with my heart, pray with my subconscious mind, pray with my soul. Please, God, I mean this. I'm asking for divine order. I'm asking you to protect me. I'm asking you to be with me. And for me, what that does is that produces a surrender. That produces an acceptance instead of an admittance. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, I'm relieved from the bondage of self again. Self tries to come back many times a day. Self manifests in very many ways. Selfishness and self-centeredness, we think, is the root of our trouble. We must be rid of this self, or it kills us, driven by 100 forms of fear and self-delusion. God, I offer myself to thee. You know, not my will, but thine be done. It's in the literature, but am I doing it? Am I doing it today? Am I doing it right now? This is what I have to ask myself. This is the real program of recovery. It's a continuous plan of action. It's not a homework assignment. It's not an intellectual assignment. It's an experiential relationship with a creator, an intelligent creator that resides inside of me. There are two powers right in me. One of them is a God consciousness, and the other one is the self. And the God consciousness always feels safe, feels open, feels receptive, feels creative. I intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle me. I intuitively come up with the answers. I intuitively have the right words. And when I'm with self, all of that's gone. And I just feel self. And I don't even know what I'm going to say, but whatever it is, it's not going to be good. So as I look at step three and I make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of this God, I have had to have had a relationship in step two with this power. Because if I don't have a relationship in step two with this power, then I'm not really going to become willing to turn my will and my life over. And again, we talk about free will all the time. I have a choice every minute of every day of blowing up my life or of turning my will and my thought life over to the care of this power. So when I look at steps one, two, and three, which are in the format of prime time, we talk about steps one, two, and three as a foundation for my life. They happen all in a split second. I see my unmanageable thought life. I have to come to believe that there's some type of power that can restore me, and I'm willing to pray to that power. So I get on the freeway, it's all chaotic and I need to get somewhere, or somebody says or does something or cuts me off, or the line's too long, or some kind of disturbance, or a family member bothers me, and I immediately go to God and I say, God, please don't let me take the bait. Don't let me take the bait. Let me just be okay. And as I continue to use this way of life, this prayer way of life, these things lift. And sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, a lot of them just vanish and don't come back. Now, through the years, as I've lived this way of life, I can see that some, like Bill Wilson said in step eight, very damaging emotional conflicts persist below the level of consciousness. Those things I really have to go in and look at, because there are some childhood traumas that don't just go because I did 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. They don't just leave because I inventoried it out in some writing exercise. I have to really go back in and see how they're blocking me and really, really, really look at how they affect my behavior in the day that I'm in. Because what neuroscientists have now showed us is that trauma is in us at a cellular level. And the memory of the trauma is in us at a cellular level. So me writing about some horrible atrocity that happened when I was 7 or 8 that discolored the pattern of my whole life, that writing exercise is not going to get it out. Interestingly enough, the scientific community will even say that sometimes we have these odd situations where somebody had a motorcycle accident and passed away, and he gave his liver to a recipient waiting for a liver transplant. This recipient gets the donated liver and all of a sudden starts having memory about that person's life. It wasn't a brain transplant. It wasn't anything that has to do with their mind. It was a different organ. But interestingly enough, the organ somehow transferred some of the memory from this person's life into this body that had nothing to do with that person's life. So I can see that to get in there and to fish around in this memory stuff is very, very, very tricky business. And that's where healthy sponsorship comes in. And that's where transparency comes in. And I'm grateful for the people in my group. I have some very, very, very close people who I talk to on a daily basis. I don't just have one sponsor. I have 2 or 3 people that I work very closely with, and I'm completely transparent with them about what my mind's saying, about what it's doing, about my sadness, about my joys, about my excitement, about my resentment, about my fear of the future. And as I process those with other people that are completely safe, I begin to have an experience with what's blocking me, because I can see, God, there's a pattern, there's another pattern, there's another pattern. But it becomes a way of life for me. And so for me, the writing exercise of the fourth and fifth stepping it out and writing the resentments in 8 and going and making amends in 9, they have done me a whole lot of good, but they haven't been the be-all, end-all for me. For me, because I've been so sick and I've come from so much trauma, It's taken an incredible amount of prayer and awareness and self-searching and connecting with my AA community, connecting with my fellows and my brothers and sisters in AA to really, really help me to grow even further and to clear away all this wreckage that blocks me from the sunlight of the Spirit. I believe that it's a lifelong journey. I don't think there's ever an ending point. I think that maybe even God wants me to have disturbances throughout my life, because the pain is the touchstone to the spiritual progress. When I'm in enough pain and I'm in enough disturbance, I devote myself to this and I go back into prayer, because I know that liquor's not going to fix it, a chocolate cake isn't going to fix it, he's not going to fix it, she's not going to fix it. And things begin to get very simple. For me, I live a very simple life. I live in a small place. I have a small business, I have one car, I have one bank account, I have some very close friends, I have a beautiful relationship with my daughter, I've overcome a lot, I lived in the street for 3 years, I was in jail 9 times, you know, I lost everything to this disease. I'm a real hopeless, hopeless alcoholic who was smitten by an insane urge that drove me into the gates of insanity. And I've come up so much higher than I ever could have without the 12 steps in my life. The 12 steps were a tool to allow me to flourish and have the potential really blossom that God always wanted for me. But self could never have done it. I had to remove self and allow self to get out of the way so that I could live in a surrendered state of consciousness with God. And what does that look like on a daily basis, and what does that feel like? Most of the time, I don't need to have the answers, and I don't know what the answers are for other people. People call me up and they say, I want to cheat on my spouse, or I feel like doing this or that, and I say, man, maybe you need that experience to hit a bottom. Maybe you need to run that thing till the wheels fall off. I'm not the manager for other people's lives. I'm not the boss. I'm not their parent. I don't even have a sponsor that works that way with me. There is one ultimate authority, and it's a loving God as He expresses Himself in my life through me and through the group. You know, and sometimes I think maybe even in sponsorship there is some overmanaging. This is an organic process where we are allowed to blossom and grow and really connect with a creative power, a creative intelligence that resides inside of us all. And it's an amazing journey. You know, if you've never come to an AA meeting, it's a beautiful experience. And the 12 steps are an amazing process. If you're ever in Los Angeles, come to our Saturday night primetime meeting. Our website is primetimeisnow.com. Lots of downloads. Everything is for fun and for free. We don't make a dime. We don't ask for anything. And that's all I've got today. Thanks for letting me share.